Hello, everyone, and welcome to podcast number 5 of Total EM. We have a very special guest with us today. His name is Min Lekong. You may be familiar with him if you are on Twitter at all looking up FOMED. His username is Ketamin. That's ketamine, but instead of the E, it's with an H. He was nice enough to come on the show. We wanted to talk to him about a few different issues, but we got really on a roll talking specifically about ketamine. No surprise there. And unfortunately, we were on such a roll, I forgot to hit the record button the first time. So we lost about a total of 10 to 15 minutes of audio. Luckily, Min Lekong was very nice, and he was very helpful and understanding. And so we record it back as best we could. We try to stay on topic and try to hit the things that we did. The actual audio of the conversation that we do have is about an hour in length, and to make it easier for people on their commute and driving and whatnot, we're going to cut it down into 2 30-minute sessions. The first one, we're talking about basically an introduction to him. We're talking about some basics about ketamine and how he's using it more right now. A little bit about how he started to use it in the first place. We talk very briefly. We don't actually mention it by name, but we do talk about the poker trial. We hope to talk about the poker trial in the show at some point on our podcast. In the meantime, Rebel EM did a very good job with it, so we'll include a link to their podcast as well as the actual paper. There are some other papers, too, that you can look up that Min's talking about. Very easy to find overall. So without further ado, let's go ahead and let's talk about our first episode.
Yeah, no problem, Chip. Look, thanks for having me on the show. Just a quick bit about myself, just as an introduction. So I'm an Australian doctor. I've been doctoring for now 23 years, and in the last 12 years, I've been a Royal Flying Doctor. Before that, I was a rural family doctor in South Australia. My wife, she's also a flying doctor. We have very similar backgrounds, and we basically have job shared a lot throughout our career and also our raising a family. I've got two kids, both in kind of high school at the moment, and I divide my time between part-time Royal Flying Doctor service. So I go out to Mount Isa base every month and do my flying doctor work out there, where we do aeromedical retrieval, inner hospital transfer, critical care, and also remote medicine. So we fly out to remote communities and provide a visiting doctor service there and do things from antenatal care to, you know, emergency work to, chronic disease care and so forth. The other part of my work is, being a father and a husband and, you know, looking after the kids and the house and so forth and our pets. And also this academic online, life that I have. I was going to call it a hobby, but it's become really more than a hobby because it is really a regular part of my life now that I check social media, I have discussions on Twitter. Sometimes, you know, we come to an agreement after having a bit of a fight on Twitter, but that's the good fun part of it. And the coolest part is, you know, with the FOMED, the Free Open Access Medical Education Community that has been set up, is that I can interact with, world-leading professionals from many countries, I have to give credit to Scott Weingart, who actually started me off on this journey. I've been following his blog and podcast for a while, and then he decided, well, why don't you, you know, you're obviously interested, why don't you set up your own? And he helped me do that. So he's a great member of the community, and big credit to the, American medical education community for having him as I think, a great ambassador for online education. Because I think he's, if you ask me what's my regular social media, FOMED, diet that I do every month, I would routinely listen to Scott every month whenever I fly, and I always learn stuff from what he and his co-authors are providing. So I think that's great, and I think it's good that, you know, other people are deciding to take up and trying to provide extra material and discussion, such as yourself. And it's not easy setting up a podcast, but
no.
It's not impossible. I think it's great. So, you know, thanks for having me on the show.
I have to give credit to Scott Weingart as well, because without him, I probably would not be podcasting, because having students, I mean, I've never met with him, never talked to him in person or anything like that, but I've had very few brief exchanges just on Twitter with him, and listening to his podcast over the past couple of years, I was really impressed. And I've been watching other podcasters and listening to him, such as the Ultrasound Podcast, stuff like that, and realized that, you know, all these students are asking me to try and teach with them, and there's lots of good conversations I have, but if I could record it and then share it and even hit an even larger population, you know, that'd be great. So it kind of led to me going down that pathway. So one thing I wanted to talk about real quick, we talked about the first time, I didn't get to really say it the second time. Australia is huge. I was messing around last night on like different country sizes, and I live in the state of Missouri, which is a decently sized state, but not as big as any of your states. And it can take you by ground, the way I was figuring it out, if you were driving nonstop, it'd take you like 3 days to go from one side of the country to the other. You've got huge areas to cover. It makes sense that you have flying docks there and the resources you guys have.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, look, it's a big country, and certainly my state of Queensland is the second largest state in the nation, and it's a huge amount of territory. My base that I work out of, Mount Isa Base, has our area of coverage is 500 kilometres radius. And it's a big area to cover. So yeah, for an example, like if I'm in Mount Isa and we need to take someone for PCI, the nearest PCI hospital is over 900 kilometers away. Oh, geez. So that's like a 12-hour drive roughly, or it's a little bit under a 2-hour fixed wing aeromedical transfer. So that's one of our common destinations to take people is to that PCI center. So yeah, it's a big place, and it's a unique part of the work in that you're dealing in remote medicine, that there's not a lot of the tertiary services out there. Like we don't have any ENT, no orthopedics, no urology. There's no, there's kind of a very basic psychiatry service there, but they don't have really any secure inpatient beds. So we have to fly a lot of psychiatric transfers over to the tertiary centre on the coast. But like I said earlier on, even though I'm out in the middle of nowhere, it's interesting because we've had a new doctor start there this year. He's living in Mount Isa for a year to get the full flying doctor experience. I ask him from time to time how he's going, because, you know, he's a single guy, and I think his girlfriend's on the coast, so it's a long-distance relationship. And I said, oh, how's it going? How are you finding me? And he goes, look, he said, from an academic viewpoint, he doesn't feel isolated at all being in such a remote site because of online free open access medical education. He said listening to podcasts like Scott's or mine, or following things on Twitter and the blog posts, he says he actually gets as good, if not better, learning than if he was back in any of the coastal cities. So that's the cool thing, and that's why I enjoy trying to help and support these kind of podcasts and this kind of online learning thing, because I know it definitely benefits my rural and remote colleagues.
I'd agree, and with our setting too. I mean, I talk about rural, and yet I still have, even at the first hospital I was at out of PA school, I was an hour away from specialists in most cases, and 2 hours away from a tertiary center. So for me, rural is much different than what you're talking about. But sometimes it almost doesn't matter. If that specialist isn't there, that specialist isn't there. It's not going to fix anything. So you still have to learn, I feel like, a lot of the same measures. Now where I'm at, it's still a rural setting. We still have limited resources, but it's much better for our patients, what we can provide now. And doing some of the pre-hospital work, where I was at pre-hospitally, the closest hospital was at least an hour away. So one of the things that our ambulance said on it was that we're the real emergency room, because for a lot of our patients, we were the main stabilizing. It wasn't like, oh, well, if we drive 5, 10 minutes to the hospital, we can make it happen. No, you've got to stabilize them at least to some degree first before you take them anywhere else. So,
Right, exactly.
one of the things that we were talking about is obviously with your Twitter name and everything else, you have a bit of a thing for ketamine. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, look, I think, how did this all begin? I think I learnt about ketamine when I was doing anesthesia training. Back, in my hospital residency years, and it really wasn't that really very much taught or emphasized, and so I kind of really forgot about it. But let's go back to the real beginning. The first time I actually saw ketamine used, or actually even gave it under supervision, was when I was a medical student doing my international elective. And my wife, who I'd met at the time, we weren't married at that point, but she had this real passion to go to Nepal to do the elective, and she had some contacts through her church that she knew some people in Nepal who could host us. And so I thought, hey, why not? I obviously love this woman, so I'm gonna just see where this all goes. This is how you discover things about life. So I'd never thought about going to Nepal, but anyway, she was going, and thought I'd follow her, and that can always be a start of exciting learning. So we went there, and we went to a hospital in Kathmandu called Tribhuvan Teaching Hospital. It's one of their main teaching hospitals, and they have an emergency department there, which is well, anyway, it's very basic. And a guy came in with a dislocated shoulder, and the supervising doctor that I was with said, "Oh, look, we're going to reduce it. You're going to give him this ketamine, and we use it a lot here in Nepal." And he handed me the syringe, and he goes, "Look, just give it slowly, and then you can put the shoulder back in." And that was my first experience seeing the effects of ketamine, and I really didn't think much of it. And like I said, when I was doing anesthesia training, it really wasn't taught that much. Then when I went out into rural general practice, one of my colleagues went away to do some upskilling, and he came back and he said, "Oh, look, this emergency department I was with, they were using a lot of this ketamine, and they were doing a lot for their procedural sedation." And so he kind of gave us a bit of a tutorial about it, and gave us the emergency department protocols from where he had learnt it. And then I just thought, oh, well, this is interesting, so let's give it a go. And so the first ketamine patient that when I was out in rural practice that I did, I was a woman who'd come in acute back pain, quite severe acute back pain. And I said, "Oh, look, you're obviously in a bit of pain, and I'd like to give you something, and try this ketamine." She goes, "Yeah, just give me whatever." And it worked, but she went on like the biggest hallucinatory trip that I've ever seen. So that was really kind of, I guess, my second experience with giving ketamine for a patient, and I think it actually served me well, because I could see that, obviously ketamine does have its issues, and it can cause people to hallucinate quite dramatically. And she did, like, she thought she was levitating off the bed and going up through the roof and all this kind of stuff. And her, it's interesting, because her partner, who I thought might be horrified, he actually started laughing.
That's good. That's good.
And he thought it was a huge joke. So he gave her some midazolam, and an hour and a bit later, she was in total pain free, but she didn't remember any of it. And so it was a good lesson to me early on about the issues of ketamine. And then so since then, really, I've just been using it more and more, in kind of, procedural sedation, emergency intubations. And then when I joined the Flying Doctors about 12 years ago, one flight I did, I think in my first year, was it the second year? Anyway, I was one of them. It was a woman with bipolar disorder who was acutely manic. And she was brought out to the aircraft in quite an agitated state, despite a lot of sedation with benzodiazepines and haloperidol. And anyway, we tried to settle her down with some more midazolam, which is what we normally did at the time, back then. And it kind of worked, but really she just wasn't getting really settled. And I thought I'd have to intubate her during the flight, which, it's not a small thing. But anyway, I remembered that colleague of mine who talks initially about the ketamine in emergencies, and I thought, oh, well, I'll give that a go. And so from that experience, which was kind of a revelation to me that you could, give someone with acute manic psychosis ketamine sedation and it actually would work better than the standard benzodiazepines, that revelation I guess sparked my 10-year or 9 to 10-year journey to where I am now, where we've done research and we've published a few papers, and we have essentially in Australia changed how we manage that patient group of acutely agitated people needing aeromedical transfer. So I'll give you an example. So back when I first started RFDS, it was essentially a written protocol that if an acutely agitated patient needed flight and it was considered that they were of some significant risk, then they were intubated and given an anaesthetic, a general anaesthetic. And whereas now, 12 years later, that is still within the protocol, but it is far down the protocol, and our rates of using intubation are, 80-90% less than what they used to be 10 years ago. So we use ketamine now routinely, and so I guess that's where I'm at with in terms of my current interest in research, is that after 9, 10 years of doing this now in aeromedical setting, acutely agitated psychotic patients, people on speed, people, agitated for many reasons, we find that the ketamine sedation works quite well. And I've lectured and talked about it many times. I've done a few podcasts, and like I said, we've now I think it's at least five aeromedical services in Australia have ketamine sedation as part of their behavioural disturbance protocol. It's now in a number of emergency departments in terms of its use. And certainly, I know I'd give kudos to pre-hospital EMS or EMS system in America, where they've been the other great research providers of the use of ketamine in a pre-hospital setting for things such as agitated delirium. So briefly, that's where I've got my interest in terms of ketamine use in emergency medicine.
Perfect. Well, for us here in the States, it seems like ketamine, there's a lot of dogma around it still. I mean, there's a lot of people who still think that, oh, you definitely can't do it in certain types of patients, they'll increase their ICP, or that, oh, if you do it, you're going to give them bad trips and all these other things. I mean, as you're just mentioning, midazolam, you can pre-treat with midazolam. And I think that's something you routinely do, if I remember correctly. You basically don't anymore give people ketamine without giving them some midazolam at the same time. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'll first talk about the evidence base for that. So there's a number of studies, one that support the use of adjunctive midazolam or benzodiazepine or antipsychotic in conjunction with your ketamine to reduce the incidence of emergence delirium hallucinations. So there's some studies that support that. There's actually others there's actually one study I remember in particular where that didn't really seem to make much difference. I personally think that you need to be prepared to handle and manage. And if there is a particular concern that the patient is at high risk of a hallucinatory adverse event, then yeah, you should offer some form of prophylaxis. So regardless of whether it happens or not, you need to know how to deal with it. And that's part of the experience of learning about ketamine is that you, as a provider, you need to know how to deal with that because it will happen. How do you prevent it? Look, I actually, well, in our protocol, we give droperidol first line. So
Oh, okay.
I never give ketamine unless it's a real emergency and, it's kind of fight club in the aircraft. I never give ketamine by itself first off. So it's usually after droperidol has either generally not worked. And there is some evidence for that published where either, I think the evidence was for haloperidol, that if you give haloperidol first, then the emergence phenomenon in ketamine afterwards is actually much less. So, and that kind of makes sense. So there's a great motto by an anaesthetist anesthesiologist in America called Brian Freeberg, who's published over his 20-year experience of using ketamine in an office setting for plastic surgery. And he basically gives the line is that if you want to use ketamine well, you first need to understand that you need to put the person to sleep first, and then you give them the ketamine. So he says, sleep first, then dissociate, I think is the line that he uses. Or and he calls it Goldilocks anesthesia. So it's just getting it just right. And basically the idea is that if you want someone to have a hallucinatory-free ketamine experience, you need to put them to sleep first. So yeah, either he recommends using propofol to actually induce someone and then giving them the ketamine, and so he uses kind of like a ketofol combination for his anesthesia, and he's published on it several times, and he claims he's had very good results.
Is he giving the propofol at the same time as the ketamine, like a ketofol, no. Or he's pre-treating, right, with the propofol?
Yeah. Okay. So he does. It's quite interesting. He does propofol. He starts a propofol infusion, and then he uses a commonly accepted monitoring system called BIS or bispectral index monitoring system, which is like an EEG that is supposed to monitor your brain waves, and it's supposed to show you the level of sedation that you have achieved. And so he recommends that you use that, and that you start the propofol drip, and once your BIS level is 70 or below, then you can give the ketamine. And so that's what he does. But I think that in emergency practice, I think what we all realize, for those who've used ketamine a lot, is that you do need to be aware that hallucinations can occur. People can have a bad trip, and we actually see that not uncommonly in certainly the era of medical sedation, but you need to know how to handle that. And certainly what I teach for our new flight doctors is, you give droperidol first, wait to see if that works. If it doesn't work, then you can initiate the ketamine sedation, because then at least you have some baseline sedation on board already. In an emergency, you can give ketamine just completely by itself. That's fine. But you obviously are doing that in an emergency, and you accept that there will be a risk of hallucinations. I think it's important to educate the patient if possible. So even agitated, psychotic people, I will still tell them, look, I'm going to give you something to make the trip a bit smoother and calmer, and you don't feel so scared. This medicine may give you some weird dreams, but I'll talk you through it, and I'll certainly explain what's going on. And I'm a big thing that you should, even for people who are still might be highly agitated and unable to give consent, I think you should still at least try to explain to them what's going on, and try to provide some kind of one-to-one interaction that at least they can be confident that they're not having this bad experience by themselves. So I think that's a big factor in helping people with their agitation.
I think if I may be remembering the right person, I think Scott Weingart even kind of talked about how he'll try and get people in a happier state of mind, try and get them relaxed as much as possible beforehand to kind of help prevent that, or at least reduce that risk of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I've kind of expanded my ketamine research into some other areas apart from aeromedical, where in the last year or so I've looked into and assisted with the role of ketamine in treating people with severe depression. And one of the things I've learned from that research experience is that, I guess in that kind of elective setting, or the kind of the thing where it's not an emergency or a crisis that you have to immediately deal with, but it's something that people are electively consenting to do, like a procedural sedation or so forth, is that how you set things up and the environment is very important. And an actual what people hear can clearly influence their experience of the ketamine dissociation. And I think that what I've learned is that noise is a very significant contributor to people's experience whilst they're under ketamine. And so therefore, certainly in the aeromedical setting, my practice has changed now, and what we are adopting now is things to mitigate noise stimulation, so headphones or ear protection, things that we weren't doing before because we just thought, well, they look sedated, so therefore they must be, you know, okay. But actually what we know now from the ketamine depression research is that the noise, certainly in the aircraft, can be very stimulating. And it kind of makes sense when you think about it. It's like, you know, in the emergency room, if you were to do a ketamine sedation on someone to reduce their, you know, fracture or whatever, you wouldn't, you know, lie them in bed, start the IV, and then as you're giving them the ketamine, you turn on, you know, 80 decibel loudspeakers right next to their ear. And you wouldn't expect them to have a good experience, would you? So what we realized in the aeromedical setting is that, well, that's what we're doing. And it explained a phenomenon. Until I did this depression research, I didn't really understand, because we'd noticed in our research in the aeromedical that some people who we dissociated with ketamine on the ground before flight, and they seemed fine. They seemed absolutely fine. They looked completely calm. And then we put them on the aircraft, we start up the engines, we take off, and then all of a sudden some of them started to get very agitated. And we thought, oh, well, maybe it's the, you know, ketamine wearing off, we need to give them more. And that was our usual response, was just to give them more. But actually what we realize now is that this idea of the noise stimulating people so much, so they're actually having a bad hallucination as a result of that auditory stimulus. So now what we do to prophylax or prevent that is, yeah, have good ear protection. And what I've been doing lately is that if there are signs that people are becoming auditorily stimulated and having a negative hallucination, is I'll actually turn off the ketamine. So in our sedations, we run ketamine infusions. I'll turn off the ketamine and I'll actually substitute it for propofol to basically deactivate the frontal lobe. Because when you're having that hallucination, that's what it is. It's an activation of your frontal lobe. And so therefore, I'll make sure that they're completely settled after with the propofol. And then I might restart the ketamine, or I might just keep going with the propofol if they're fine. And then I might substitute some additional ketamine if it's not adequate. So some really interesting things. So, you know, and actually the depression research I got into has kind of one of these kind of really cool things about online social media FOMED networking is that you kind of make network, you network with people with similar interests, and they kind of you realize that your research interests are the same. So how I got involved with the depression research was that a psychiatrist who contacted me just via social media and says, oh, look, I'm writing a book on ketamine for depression, and I saw one of your papers on aeromedical sedation. I just wanted to reference this. I'm just asking you for permission. And so we kind of got talking and, you know, involved and in terms of talking about ketamine depression. And he was treating a few people with depression. And so, you know, he was going to start trialing people on intravenous ketamine. And he said, oh, look, you've got more experience about intravenous ketamine than I have. So can you be a consultant on these cases? And so that's how I got involved in that. And I actually learnt me quite a lot that allowed me to kind of see how I could improve aeromedical sedation. So, so that's the cool thing about
it. It sounds like it's really come to help out your patients, especially when you talk about, you know, that training with the depression side and how you've better noticed how people are having problems in flight. It kind of led me to a question, though. You talked about you'll switch over to propofol if you notice they're having auditory hallucinations or other problems with the ketamine. Do you think, and I'm just totally speaking off the cuff, so I don't know if this is at all accurate, but I mean, would ketofol possibly help with that? Would that be one of the benefits of throwing in those two drugs together versus just, oh, we'll do ketamine, oh, we'll do propofol, you know, one of those types. We'll just pre-treat from the beginning, or we can switch over to that kind of method and provide more of a balanced sedation, but a pretty safe sedation.
Yeah, no, great question. As you know, recently in, I think it was Annals of Emergency Medicine, or was it the Journal of Emergency Medicine? It was one of them. It was certainly put out on Twitter, but there was this big discussion about this recent paper, which basically showed that, you know, allegedly that ketofol wasn't any better than standard propofol in emergency sedation in an emergency room. And look, that's actually been my long held belief for a long time. But having said that, with this, you know, what I've done with this research with depression and also with aeromedical sedation, I think there possibly is a useful role for that. There's a randomized trial being run right now in Northern Territory, far north Australia in Darwin, with one of our sister aeromedical services, where they're randomizing to ketamine or propofol. And it'd be interesting, you know, depending on how that trial goes, to look at the ketofol mix. Because I am doing it right now. I'm basically doing a ketofol type sedation, but right. I'm not kind of mixing the two drugs together. I'm kind of using them separately to kind of have the same effect. But whether you can have the mixed cocktail to do the same thing, it would be interesting, I have to say. I think that that may well be the future in terms of a research avenue. I'm waiting to see what the RCT done in the Northern Territory will show. Currently, I asked the chief investigator a few weeks ago how it's going, and they said, oh, it looks like the ketamine group is doing better, which is certainly my experience. But
ketamine's always better, right?
Yeah, well, you know, but I think, you know, we can't say it's a miracle thing. It's because people do have bad hallucinations on it. There's no doubt about that. And how you handle that, I think, is going to be the true sign about whether you can use ketamine effectively. And so I think that's what I'm doing at the moment is, yeah, if having a bad hallucination on ketamine, I'll stop it and substitute propofol. But in the future, it may well be that the ketofol mix might actually be a bit better. And no one knows yet. No one's done it.
Right.
So
I'm curious about that.
No one's done it. So I think what people have done is ketofol looking at anesthesia and emergency room sedation. But, you know, for handling agitated people during aeromedical transfer, no one's done that yet. People have done ketamine by itself, propofol by itself. At the moment, I'm kind of doing a hybrid where, you know, you start one and if that's not working, you switch to the other. And it'll be interesting because it definitely seems to go smoother. It just helps me with that situation that I've noted is that some people do have a bad trip when you know, turn on the engines and you take off to flight. And then what we previously were doing was just kept giving them more ketamine. But now I realize that actually after my depression research is that I realize that actually is not the right thing to do. Because basically when you're having a bad trip, what the brain is telling you is that your frontal lobe is activated. And giving you more ketamine, if anything, is just going to keep activating your frontal lobe. You will get to a point of ketamine plasma level where you'll actually get complete general anesthesia and it will start blunting the frontal lobe activity. But before that, it's probably much more sensible to do something to reduce the frontal lobe activity. And that's, barbiturates, propofol, benzos, but certainly the propofol works nicely. Yeah.
All right. And we're going to have to stop it there so we can keep it around a half hour in total. Obviously, stay tuned. We're going to be doing the second part of this. It'll be podcast number 6 regarding kind of the last half hour of the first conversation I had with Min Lekong. Again, very awesome, very helpful. Definitely someone you want to talk to at some point if you ever get the chance. So in other words, just hang on tight. Give us a little more time. We'll release the second half of this conversation that we had. And until then, continue to provide total care everywhere. Thanks.